sighed. Why, do you not like this music? I started toward the glass doors of the main building. It reminds me of things. Like what? Like the Tet Offensive. Carol Williams was waiting for us in the entryway. I've got them corralled in the library section of the recreation room, but they're restless. I'll try not to say anything that might touch them off. We don't want to stampede. She smiled and led us into the interior of the building, where we wound our way down the corridors, finally making a left by the ramp next to the pool table, which led us into the open area where I'd been before. The four flagships were in field presentation, the major branches of the armed forces sitting in their wheelchairs with their arms collectively folded. They ignored me with Talmudic concentration. "Gentlemen, we didn't do anything." Clifton unfolded his arms, but then, with nothing else to do with them, adjusted his boonie hat. "Well, for starters, what do you suppose I think you did?"
"Stole that painting."
Delmar blurted it out before realizing what he'd said, and then glanced at the others before slamming his mouth shut. Kenny turned to him.
"Damn it, Delmar!"
Trying to hide a smile, I addressed all of them. "And what painting is that?" They tightened their folded arms in a collective wall of silence. "All right, guys, let me tell you what I think I know, and then you better start filling in the blanks, or else."
"Or else what?"
Ray fixed me with a defiant glare. "I'll bust all of you. As near as I can tell, the painting in question is the property of the United States government, and theft thereof is in direct violation of federal law, which means I can charge all of you as accessories in a conspiratorial act on a federal level akin to terrorism. Now that means I'll be dishonorably discharging all of you, and you'll be relieved of your military benefits." Vic, having walked past them to stare out the window, turned to glance at me with a wide-eyed look, fully aware that this was an inordinate and monumental display of horseshit. Figuring I needed to ratchet it up yet another notch, I turned to Carol. "What's on the menu tonight?" She fixed them with a hard stare.
"Pizza."
The four horsemen looked at one another, torn at the thought of being deprived. Navy grumbling at Air Force.
"I told you it wouldn't work. Shut up, Kenny." "You shut up, Ray."
The airman grunted.
"He was always talking about that damn painting. But how it was going to be his retirement."
He gestured to the area around them,
like he wasn't already retired here in God's waiting room.
"Tell me about the painting. You've seen it?" Clifton grumbled a response.
"Oh, we called bullshit on it so many times that he finally hauled it out and showed it to us."
Kenny added,
"With some help."
"What do you mean?"
"That thing was huge, and with all of us in wheelchairs, it was kind of unwieldy, if you catch my drift."
"So who helped?" None of them spoke. "Gentlemen, if you don't cooperate with me on this, I will make sure that you never see another pizza as long as you live."
"Magic Mike Bursaw."
"Semper Fi." I thought about the second-floor window, plastered with stickers, and the speakers blaring 60s music over the parking lot. "The disc jockey?"
"Yeah, him. He's a big guy and could carry the thing."
Delmar the Marine rolled his chair backward and pointed toward a large event table.
"Late one night, Charlie Lee got Mike to wrestle the thing out here and unroll it on the table, rolled the damn thing right off the end of the table, in fact, and started off down the hallway."
Navy nodded.
"Mike's big, but he ain't real handy."
Army added his 2 cents.
"Deaf as a post."
Air Force affirmed.
"Oh, that damn rock and roll music. Or working the decks on an aircraft carrier and didn't wear his ear protection."
I sighed as they collectively nodded.
"When was this?"
"Vietnam."
I sighed.
"No. When was the last time you saw the painting?"
"About a month ago when the Russians showed up."
Navy added.
"He's deaf-mute. Now how the hell did working on an aircraft carrier rob him of speech?"
Ignoring him, I tried to get the conversation back on the rails. "Then what happened to the painting?" Air Force shrugged.
"What do you mean, then what? Mike rolled it up and carried it back to Charlie Lee's room."
"And that was the last you saw of it?"
"Yeah."
Marine Corps spoke up.
"We tried to get him to cut it up."
Vic glanced at me again and then addressed the man.
"What?" "Well, it was a big old thing, so we thought he could cut it up and share it. You know, give us all a piece for our retirement."
I smiled and massaged the bridge of my nose with a thumb and forefinger. "Did he happen to tell you how he came into possession of the painting?" Clifton took the lead.
Said he saved it from a fire in Texas.
Fort Bliss in 46?
Something like that.
So he stole it?
No, he didn't.
I said nothing and waited as the old soldier pulled at his lower lip.
He told me about it after he showed us the damn thing, about how he worked in the commissary connected to the officers' club, washing dishes in the kitchen, when the place caught on fire. He said it was bad, an old wood building that went up like rice paper and kindling. The CO was a real asshole and ordered them into this thing to try and save the silverware and whatnot, but nobody said anything about the painting. Anyway, Charlie Lee went back in three times, the next to last time hauling one of his buddies out by covering the two of them up with the only thing that was handy. The painting. Clifton nodded.
With the heat, whatever it was they glued the thing to the wall with, let go, and it was lying there on the floor. Charlie Lee said that the rafters were falling and there was fire everywhere and that covering themselves up with the painting was the only thing that saved them.
Go on. When they got out, the CO started screaming at them for not getting the company loving cup or some nonsense, and Charlie Lee started to tell him about the painting, but the piece of shit tells him to shut his nigger mouth and get to policing the area, and Charlie Lee does as he's told and holds the painting away, rolling it up and throwing it in a trash bin. Later that night, he was coming back from taking a shower, and the damn thing was still there, so he took it. And I don't blame him one damn bit.
He had it all these years
in his closet.
Where did the smaller painting come from? The proof? They looked at me blankly. Never mind about that. You gentlemen are aware that the painting is no longer in Charlie Lee's room, right? They looked genuinely surprised.
It's not?
No, it's not. I looked at each of them, one by one. Do any of you have even the slightest idea as to who might have taken it? Delmar looked at me like I was the Fort idiot.
Told you, Russians!
Did any of you actually see Russians take it? They all looked at one another.
I mean, physically see Russians in here taking it.
They were silent for the first time. Is there anything else you think you should tell me? They looked at one another once again and then agreed. Kenny, the first to speak.
No.
If you think of anything more, any of you, will you tell me?
They nodded. I turned and headed back into the main building.
Let's go.
Vic and Carol trailed after, Vic pulling up beside me.
Where?
To make a request with a bullet.
He can be difficult.
I paused. Is he really deaf-mute? Carol nodded.
Pretty much.
And how do you communicate with him?
We have a staff member, Diane Morris, who knows sign language, but
is she around?
I doubt it. She generally works nights. I can sign.
We both stopped on the landing between the stairs, and I turned to look at my undersheriff, who rested her hands on her hips.
What?
You can sign?
Yeah, I learned from the kid who worked the snack shack at the pool, where I lifeguarded every summer back in Philly. I might be a little rusty, but I think I can get the thought across.
I shook my head. Wonders never cease. Sympathy for the devil rattled the door in its frame. Above was a glowing red light that read, On the Air. I looked at Carol. It's just wired to the lights in his room. Maintenance did it kind of as a joke, but at least you can always tell if he's home or if you need him to answer the door. He's even got a text-to-speech recorder for when he needs to use the phone. She raised her hand and flipped the light on and off. Nothing happened for a few moments, and then the volume of the music dropped a bit as Carol reflipped the switch. He's used to us asking him to lower the volume on the music. She continued flipping the switch, and finally the knob turned and the door opened approximately 3 inches. There was a lot of hair and one luminescent blue eye which stared out at us.
Hi, Mike Bursaw.
Vic ran her tongue over her teeth and smiled a pepsodent smile, making a quick movement with her hands as he continued to stare at her with the one eye. She signed, Can we come in? His hand, decorated with numerous rings and bracelets, the index and middle finger being taped together like a bird's mouth, came out the door as he signed back. Vic, undeterred, made the same gesture and a bit more.
No, really?
She persisted, her hands dancing. We're from the sheriff's department and have a few questions. He didn't respond, but didn't close the door either. I spoke as Vic turned to look at me. You know, the Stones didn't play the song for 7 years after the stabbing at the Altamont Speedway concert in 69. She translated, and he opened the door a little more. I began again. Bobby Kennedy was killed the day Jagger started writing the song, but you probably know that. She translated, but the door didn't move. Vic stared at him and then joined in singing and signing the chorus. Woo, woo. The door swung open a bit, and she leaned forward, peered inside, then pushed it open and disappeared. We followed. I went in after Carol and stood there looking at the floor-to-ceiling racks of old 45s. Good Lord. There were thousands of records that took up every inch of available wall space, all carefully arranged in the wire racks with labels noting the artists. Fishing nets and tie-dyed fabric covered the ceiling, and incense burned on a sideboard, where an elaborate turntable spun the stones, seven more singles stacked above the needle, ready to drop. Magic Mike was nowhere to be seen, but soon returned through a beaded curtain that covered an opening that looked like it had been sledgehammered through the concrete blocks. He was carrying what I assumed to be a cup of tea and handed it to Vic. Then he glanced at us. Carol nodded and he disappeared again. I gazed around the room, especially at the psychedelic-looking painted floor with sweeping stars and galaxies. I feel like I just fell into the Velvet Underground. Carol slipped sideways and looked into the homemade expansion. We may be the only ones who've been in here since the Nixon administration. He returned with two more mugs with fluttering tea bags and then gestured toward the four beanbag chairs that slouched on the floor. Doing the best I could to leverage myself down, I joined the others as we sat and got a better look at Magic Mike Birsall. He wore a wool watch cap, his hair a mottled explosion of black with gray streaks blossoming from under the elastic and trailing over his shoulders and down his back, where it joined with a massive beard of the same color that sprouted out from his face and dropped down to an impressive stomach. He was wearing a pair of brown sweatpants and a faded Hawaiian shirt. Both hands were completely encased in rings and bracelets, and he studied all of us for a moment, but mostly concentrated his attention on Vic. The record changer finished up with the Rolling Stones and dropped Marianne Faithfull's Monday Monday as we sat there drinking tea. Getting Vic's attention, I promoted the line of questioning I wanted to pursue. Ask him if he knows Charlie Lee Stillwater. She made a few quick gestures, and I watched as he responded. Vic said nothing, so I asked, what did he say? He wants to know if we like our tea. Tell him it's great, but he needs to answer my questions. She translated, and he responded with a quick gesture as my undersheriff turned to look at me. He wants to know why.
Why what?
Carol ventured.
Why answer your questions?
No, I suppose, why do we want to know if he knew Charlie Lee Stillwater? She made a series of gestures to which he responded, and she made a face. No, he wants to know why we like the tea. He says he makes it himself from the herb garden in the old chicken shed. He says it's a pu'er, fermented and oxidized. Carol nodded toward the back of the building. The National Register of Historic Places, chicken shed. I nodded. Tell him it's the greatest tea I've ever had in my life, which is not much of a stretch. To our surprise, Magic Mike laughed heartily. Carol nodded. It reads lips pretty well. I sighed, shook my head, and turned back to him. Did you know Charlie Lee? He nodded. Did you know about the painting he had? He nodded. Did you help him show it to the waivers? He nodded again. And then put it back in the cubby behind the closet where Charlie kept it hidden? Mike nodded once more. After he died, it was taken from his room, right? He shrugged. Do you have any idea who might have taken it? He shook his head. Did you ever see anybody talking or visiting with Charlie Lee who seemed suspicious, people who shouldn't have been around here? He smiled, finally gesturing, and Vic translated. You mean the Russians?
Possibly.
Which Russians? He raised his face, then sipped his tea and signed as Vic translated. There was one man who was very heavy-set, with another who had a head of wild-looking hair, and a woman.
Blonde, small, attractive?
He glanced at Vic and signed. Not as attractive as me, evidently. When did he see them? There was a flurry of signing. Charlie Lee would talk to them on the porch of the administration building or out where the benches are near the old missiles park. She paused for a moment. He showed the woman
the National Register of Historic Places chicken shed, where he grows the herbs for his tea. He turned back to Vic and gestured some more. He'd like to know if we'd like to see his chicken coop. Maybe some other time. Dropping the hand signs, she smiled. Apparently it's pretty unique. He says he captures the rainwater in a cistern and uses that for a gravity-fed irrigation system. Carol nodded. It's quite a layout.
I'm sure it's very interesting.
Vic watched him sign some more. He says the chicken manure makes for a very rich soil content.
I'm sure.
I put the mug on the floor. Mike, when were the Russians here last? He gestured, and Vic spoke. The woman and the man with the hair were here about a month ago, and then the fat guy showed up asking some questions about a week ago. He showed him the historic chicken coop. The heavyset guy, Serge Bushirov, did he seem nervous or anything? He answered in the negative. Somebody killed him this morning. He didn't seem surprised by the news. Yep, it would appear that the guy with the hair, Count von Lehmann, is also dead. He said nothing. You don't have anything to say about that? Not so surprisingly, he remained silent. You seem kind of involved in all this. He took a moment to respond with his hands as Vic spoke. Not really, he says. He just knew Charlie Lee and helped him when he needed it, that's all. Not against the law, is it? It was about then that I fought the law and the law won, dropped onto the turntable, the 45 catching traction as the needle fell. Nope. I studied him and Vic signed my words. You're sure the woman was with Serge about a week ago? He took his time, his face hidden in all the hair, and then stared at me and slowly nodded. I stood and looked at the record spinning. That singer, Bobby Fuller, died in 66, overcome by gasoline fumes from an open gas can in his unlocked car, no keys in the ignition. His body was covered in bruises and he was soaked in fuel, a number of his fingers broken. The L.A. County coroner ruled his death a suicide, but then 3 months later they changed the cause of death to accidental asphyxiation. I moved toward the door as the women joined me. Personally, I think the record label mob connections were responsible, and they were getting ready to torch the car with Fuller in it when they got interrupted. Bursaw still sat, looking up at me, and signing as Vic spoke. And you're telling me this because? The two women joined me at the door as I ushered them out, and then turned to look back at Magic Mike. It's a big, dangerous world out there, and it's important to have friends. By the way, I know you're the one who called Bass Townsend and informed him that his grandfather was dead. I turned the doorknob in my hand and slowly closed the door behind us as the song played on. Chapter 14. When we arrived back at the office, Barrett was sitting on my dispatcher's counter. He was reading a copy of Outdoor Life with his hiking boots on Ruby's desk. I stopped at the top of the stairs. What the hell are you doing here? He looked up from his magazine. It's Friday.
It is?
Yep. He stared at me as Vic joined us, and I turned to her. Is it Friday?
All day.
Nobody tells me these things. I turned back to the kid. One of your jobs is going to be telling me what day it is.
It's Friday.
You only have to do it once a day.
Got it.
Get your feet off Ruby's desk. Starting toward my office, I muttered. What time is it? Am I responsible for that, too?
Sometimes.
This job is far more wide-ranging than I thought. I glanced up at Seth Thomas on the wall above the old fireplace and noted it was 2 minutes before 5 p.m.
Ruby leave early?
Wow, 2 minutes before the hour is early around this place? Vic nodded. We run a tight ship. Barrett lowered his feet and stood, then walked around the counter, and I had my first look at him in the uniform of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department. I had to admit, the kid looked pretty sharp. You know, you don't have to wear that when you're dispatching, right?
Yeah.
He glanced at himself. I kind of like it. Helps to remind me that the job is real. I tried to hide the smile as best I could. The thrill of the badge is what we used to call it, but it can get heavy after a while.
I'm kind of enjoying it.
He actually polished his star with a cuff. Ruby said I was doing so well that she was going home. 5 minutes early?
Yeah, it's not much in the way of confidence, but it's something.
I continued to head to my office. I'm sure you'll be fine. He followed us, making it as far as the doorway, where he hung an arm. Vic occupied the guest chair and propped her boots on the edge of my desk. He glanced at her. How come she gets to put her feet up on the desks? Because I do what I want, meat.
Meat?
As in rookie or new meat. He folded his arms and leaned on the door jamb. When do I stop being meat? When you cease being a liability. Of course, for some guys, that can be a fucking career. She glanced up at him. Now go away. The real cops want to talk. He sighed and looked at me. One more thing. I was wondering if there was anything else I can do. I mean, there are long times and I'm just sitting out here. Not like TV, is it? I studied him with a smile. They also serve who only stand and wait. He stared at me. John Milton, Sonnet 19. He continued to stare at me. There's a department library out there in the main office. I suggest you continue your reading. Or badge polishing. Vic flipped her fingers at him in dismissal, one in particular. Shaking his head, he swung away with a smile. I lowered my voice. Kind of hard on the kid, weren't you?
Not really.
She turned to look at me. So, how'd you know it was Mike that called Bass? Bass said the man had a mechanical voice and that he had simply stated that Charlie Lee was dead and hung up, something a man who was deaf would do, being incapable of hearing the person on the other end. I raised my face and turned a bit, looking out the window. I have an undercover operation in mind, but it needs to be done under the cover of darkness, so we have to do something else for a while.
Like?
Well, we could go check on Bass Townsend and Contrita at the Absaroka County Sheriff's Annex over at the Blue Gables Motel.
Deal.
Suddenly remembering something, I shouted out to the new dispatcher trainee, Hey, Baird, where's my dog? He appeared in the doorway with the dog at his feet. Is this one of my responsibilities, too? Bess Townsend and Katrina DeJean were enjoying iced coffees while sitting in the metal lawn chairs at the Blue Gables Inn. I climbed out of the vehicle and headed for the office. Vic called after me. Where are you going? To get a cup of coffee to wash out my taste buds from that horrible tea.
Get me a cappuccino, please. My mouth tastes like ass.
When I got back, Bass was strumming the old resonator guitar in his lap and softly singing an Elmore James tune, Dust My Broom. How do you feel? He smiled and looked up at me as I handed Vic her fancy coffee.
Pretty good. I've just been sitting around here entertaining this fine young lady.
I glanced at Katrina before taking off the top of my cup and sipping. And you? Her smile was a little less enthusiastic. I'm here. We need to talk.
Okay.
Preferably alone. She glanced at the others and then back at me.
Yes, sir.
I led the way back to my truck. Vic began talking with Bass as he continued to strum. Flipping the tailgate down on my truck, I gestured for Katrina to sit. Welcome to my office.
Nice view.
Having a little trouble, she handed me her coffee and sidled up, looking around as I handed it back.
How can I help you?
I sat next to her. I've been talking to the boys up at the Soldiers and Sailors Home, and there's an individual who claims Serge came by no more than a week ago. She looked surprised.
Who says that?
Never mind for the moment. Do you think it's true? She started to speak, but then stopped, finally breathing out the word,
Yes.
She sipped her coffee. If something were to happen to Philippe, I can only surmise that Serge was under orders to retrieve the painting, or maybe he was after it for himself. Someone broke into Charlie Lee's apartment at the veteran's home. She shrugged. If it was broken into, I can only surmise that Serge did it. If he was released from the Sheridan County Jail yesterday, and as near as DCI can tell, he was killed only hours later, it would have been kind of difficult for him to get over here and break into Charlie Lee's room in that amount of time. I shook my head. Let's say he did it the night before. What would he have done with it? If he had found the painting, then he would have taken it for himself or someone else. Someone like Clover Puskov? She looked slightly shaken at the thought.
I hope not.
Why? She put her empty coffee cup on the tailgate.
Well, then, it's gone.
Not necessarily. I spoke with him on the phone an hour ago, and he's turning his plane around in Helsinki and coming back. I shrugged. If our runway is long enough. She looked stunned. Why would he do that? I was kind of wondering about that myself. I turned to look at her more closely. Do you suppose he has the painting?
It's possible.
Then why would he come back? Perhaps he left the painting in Helsinki? Nope, I made a call and spoke with the ground security of the private section of the airport, and they assured me that nothing came off the plane and the only things that were brought on board were paperwork, food, and fuel. Maybe he thinks he can still get the painting now that Philippe and Serge are dead.
Maybe.
I waited, but she said nothing. Which means that whoever has the painting is in danger if Klavdiy Kolpakouskov is as capable as I'm led to believe. I waited a moment before adding, you don't get a name like the Bloodletter for nothing. She turned away, studying the distance. I don't know where the painting is. I continued to study her. Okay, I believe you. But who does? Her head dropped. The only two people I know of who could have had such knowledge are dead. And in all honesty, those two unsolved murders are the priority for me. I sipped my now cold coffee. I think they are connected with the painting.